Okay, it's after 6 p.m. on Wednesday, May 23rd, and this is the Josephine County Rural Planning Commission. The workshop is continued on home occupations proposed ordinance. And we usually do the roll call of the members to see who's here and who's not here. We can just state names. Who's here is Dave Church.
Ron Rank.
Ronald Glenn.
Malcolm Drake.
And staff members Dave Wagner and Valerie Montague.
Okay. So with that, I think we can move right into the agenda. It says introduction is the first item, and you may remember we had a workshop. What date was that? Whatever date it was. Anyway, previously, and we reviewed the proposed ordinance from the Home Occupations Subcommittee that met. And we're here to continue that workshop. And I don't really have any other more introductory comments than that, other than to maybe ask if our staff, Planning Director David Wagner, has anything he would like to start us off with.
Well, we've got a few documents in front of you. One is the Home Occupation Ordinance Workshop topics. We decided to just focus on the ones that came out from our last workshop. We just had a few items that people wanted to take another bite at the apple on, so we're doing that. We're also going to talk about fees, and there's a document titled Home Occupation Application and Fee Outline. Should be in your packet. We also have definitions for home occupations, and I do want to spend some time this evening talking about the accessory living quarters, which is a document or a issue that we didn't talk much about last time, and we'd like to talk about that tonight. That is accessory living quarters, habitable structures in the residential commercial or in the commercial zone, which are usually
kind of a separate issue. Or are we going to wedge these two?
We're going to put these two together and hear them at the same time. It's kind of a standalone issue, and I wanted to tie it to something closely related. So, and we have gotten some letters of support for that particular issue. Let the meeting notes reflect that Margaret Goodman has joined us. We also have a draft ordinance, Article 92, and we incorporated a few things from the last workshop, added those to the materials. Do you have a copy for her?
I just gave it to her.
Okay. You're all over it. With that as introduction, I think I want to turn it over to Valerie Montague and have her kind of lead us through her documents that she primarily put together. Take it away.
All right. So these are basically oriented towards some issues that came up at the last workshop. One of the things that came up was we had, for vehicle-oriented businesses, a limit of two, and then it would go to a type two home occupation, and then it would go up to a type three for anything over two vehicles. And Ward Ockenden thought that it should be more permissive to allow for more vehicles. I did go through our code to see if there was anything that would tie into the number of vehicles allowed. Not a lot in the code. However, in the rural residential zone, just to have four vehicles in open storage, one way is for non-commercial purposes, for unlicensed vehicles, but also if they are stored vehicles not owned by the property owner or the resident, then you can only have up to four, and it's a CUP. So that's definitely a conditional use permit, which is a pretty intensive review. So,
You mean if you want to have that many in a rural residential zone, you have to obtain a conditional use permit.
Right.
Okay, I got you.
So tying that into what you would be doing as a business owner of a vehicle-oriented business, you're basically saying the same thing. Four vehicles on your property that aren't yours. So I changed the language in the ordinance to say up to three as a type two. Over three would be a conditional use permit or type three.
Consistent.
So it's consistent with the code.
Okay.
And I did bring in the automobile wrecking yard language just because it was one of the very other few references to vehicle limitations in any zone.
So, Valerie, can I ask a question?
Of course.
Okay. Basically, you're saying this is brought into the existing code, so I would be comfortable with a lot more cars than that if they weren't visible from the road, but I'm not into trying to change the existing code either, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can have more cars, you just get a CUP.
Or just don't tell anybody.
There's that,
too. I suspect that's going to happen.
And it doesn't become an issue until the administrator gets a call and then she enforces the code.
Okay.
I have a question about the parts that have not been removed. Could somebody get around this simply by removing a windshield wiper?
Well, that's actually not something that's on the table for us to change. This is existing code that I'm referencing just to keep consistent with the new home occupation ordinance. Mm-hmm. So I'm comparing it to what else exists in the code regarding vehicles. Mm-hmm. So that's not actually a part of the ordinance that we're reviewing.
So out of curiosity, for the part that is already there, is that, could someone get around that just by taking off the windshield wipers?
Where
I haven't even considered that.
I'm looking at 11.030 definition of automobile wrecking yard.
Oh, okay.
And it says any property where the dismantling, salvaging, storing, disposing, assigning, car, vehicle, or trailer is conducted or the open storage of five or more unlicensed vehicles not in running condition from which parts have not been removed. So could you take up the windshield wiper and then say, hey, I've removed parts. Okay. 500 vehicles. But they're all looking
for. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I was not following you, but the idea is you can have a lot more vehicles that are partially salvaged, or you can store five that don't run but are not salvaged.
Yeah, it seems like there's
that is
a lot.
That is a little confusing, isn't it?
It's a loophole.
Like before my time, I don't even want to mess with it.
Yeah. it's kind of recreation.
Margaret, you can feel free to remove your windshield wipers if you like.
No, I'm just saying, if I have 500 non-running unlicensed cars on my property, all I would need to
she
do
does.
Remove the windshield wipers, and they're all then within the code. So I don't think we need to worry about this not being enough cars.
And the only other thing that I would say is that in resource zones, that automobile-type businesses could be an issue because the ORS requires that that a home occupation operates substantially within a dwelling or a building. So that's just something that would come up because it does have to be consistent with the ORS, and that would come up during the review. All right. We had...
But for anything except things like... wood production and wood crafts and stuff that you...
That would come under a whole... That's under similar and related businesses that are associated with resource uses.
So that's not part of the home op, okay.
No.
Yeah, and that's kind of a distinction that I want the Planning Commission to keep in mind, and I assume when we get testimony on this in a public hearing, because we hear it all the time, folks aren't quite distinguishing what's a business that's allowed in a few zones and some of our zones do allow businesses, and then what's a home occupation, because that's
right.
Different. So Article 92 is just... So
like your
home
stand
occupation.
For farm stands
right.
And wood products would be a business, not a home occupation. Then. And
right.
Right.
If you were raising butterflies, as some folks do in the conjunction, and you happen to sell them on the Internet, I guess people actually do that, they box them up and send them to people and you buy a live butterfly. That could be a home occupation. If you've got a butterfly pavilion and you're selling tickets to come onto your property, that's not considered a home occupation.
And that's why, because there's enough of those instances because of the resource lands and the different types of uses that are allowed to come in as different types of either permitted uses or standards only type of uses. I did have those covered in 92090 just to make them specific. There's farm stands, there's commercial uses in association in conjunction with farm uses. So
right.
I tried
and
to...
Forest also.
Exactly. Okay, so previously we had large appliance repair business as a prohibited business, and Commissioner Ockenden took exception to that.
You say objects?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So...
I can object too, but I'm not sure what is the issue with... That's so critical that it's going to impact the neighbors.
They tend to stack up. Refrigerators,
yeah.
Washers, dryers, solid debris is an issue around here quite often.
Oh, yeah.
We have a lot of instantaneous junkyards that just kind of show up over time.
Well, you know, we discussed this at the last meeting, mm-hmm. and I said, hey, if they've got it blocked off where you can't see it from the road with the neighbors, who cares? I know Don Moore said, well, you know, if it's refrigerators, you can get the free on.
That's true, too.
And I don't know what... I suppose that's true.
There are some issues.
I was probably the only one that has any... I don't even know if that's a hazard except for the ozone.
Okay. Well, let's have some discussion about that.
There was some issue of screening. I think we had mentioned that, mm-hmm. and I was thinking that one of these types of permits and said things had to be, oh, here it is, type 2, storage materials on site be screened from neighboring properties by a solid fence or vegetation or other structures.
So there's a couple.
So okay. If the appliance repair business was a type 2, it would have to be screened anyway. Right? Am I reading that right?
I would say about the only way they could have anything stored outside would create it, would make it reviewed at a level 2, at a type 2.
Mm-hmm.
For any business, any home.
Any business that has outdoor storage or outdoor activity, it would automatically become a type 2.
Okay. So that, I wonder if Ward's not here, but mm-hmm. I wonder if that would alleviate his concern. He wanted more, and you said you did too, Malcolm.
More
storage allotment rather than less.
Yeah, I think at the last workshop somehow we came up with two appliances. I couldn't find that anywhere though. But
yeah.
That would have to do with the automobiles.
I remember the automobiles,
right.
So that didn't have the appliances. Yeah.
So I removed it from the prohibited list and I put it on type 3 occupations. Some occupations.
Okay.
It could go type 2 or type 3.
I got you. Okay.
So do we want to put that someplace or?
You mean, do we want to?
Type 3 is prescriptive in the draft that you have.
Yeah.
So large appliance repair is a type 3. But you just mentioned that the screening,
well,
it sounds like the screening you'd be happy with is
I'd
a type 2.
Yeah.
So we can remove it from 3 and call it a type 2 because if there's any outdoor storage, obviously if you're in a building or in an accessory structure, and you worked on one at a time, it could even be a type 1.
I would be comfortable with moving the large appliance repair out of type 3, just striking it, and then it therefore becomes a type 2.
It would fall wherever the proposal
It would fall,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Agreed.
That's just me. Okay.
Yeah, I like that.
Care what they do as long as I don't have to look at it.
Simplification is always good.
There's some places I drive by online that drive that I guess they're just junkyards now. It's unbelievable.
Non-sanctioned.
I think they bought another lot because it's spread up the hill. The place that I would have bought and built a rental 20 years ago, except that I didn't want the renters to drive by the building.
I actually slow down and show out-of-town guests the toilet.
The toilet house?
I like that.
Yeah.
That character.
On Monument Drive. This guy has put about 15 of them, something like that.
Something like all different colors.
Toilets.
Right across from Antlers.
Certainly
in
the...
I haven't seen that. Yard.
Antlers is gone now. But
yeah,
it's like a circle of thrones. On the front lawn.
It looks like a ceramic.
They're planters.
A porcelain stone.
They're not toilets.
They're planters.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have events there or not. I hope not. Whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. Moving on. We're being taped.
Sorry about that.
Access?
So.
Access is covered because of the fact that at a type 2, we go to site plan review standards, and it's automatically brought up in that list of standards. As a type 1, the thought is that the impacts are such that they're not going to really impact traffic patterns in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
They're not huge. So unless that's a concern, you know, it's...
The nature of the business will limit the traffic.
Right.
Can you review why type 2 is a serious impact on the neighborhood? I could do it, but I haven't.
So type 2 is a standards only. So it's an in-house type of review. We don't have a site visit. We're not noticing the neighbors because the way that the operation is occurring, it does not have any impact to the neighborhood that really are going to be huge.
Okay, so I thought you said that type 2 had to have the roads reviewed.
But there would be a notice to other agencies, yes.
Yes, I'm sorry,
and public
type
courts.
1.
Yeah, but type 2 is there's enough people going in and out.
Right.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I misspoke.
All right. Just don't let it happen.
And adequate access, threw that into the, onto this, the definition of adequate access. So that's the proposal on page 2 of the Home Ordinance Workshop Topics.
And it does specifically mention home occupations.
So you're not going to have this one on the Credit Street then?
Well, if the definition of adequate access is changes to it and we get a private road standard, then that we
might have to opt
as well. The now we've cautioned folks in the past that are doing a home occupation that if they're on a private street, they need to look at their easement documents and make sure that the road maintenance agreement doesn't, you know, their neighbors may object to more traffic on the road if they're paying the fix.
This could be true on a restricted residential too, right?
What's that?
Could be, I mean, it would be an issue on a restricted residential. I mean, if somebody's got a lot of traffic and they're not paying but, you know, one-fifth of the maintenance cost, I could see that as a real... Possible we're not addressing that in this.
Okay. I'm just saying you got to have the access.
Yeah.
And it's.
I mean, would you expect that if somebody came in and wanted to do a type 3 on a restricted residential road, you'd say that's not adequate access?
But, well, we defer to Public Works in their opinion because we're noticing that agency.
Okay.
So, yeah, or that department.
Okay.
And finally, the last issue on home occupation ordinance workshop topics was the registered home occupation. And this is, we were calling it exempt in the ordinance. And I think Goodwin brought up a good point, which was if they're exempt, why are they doing anything?
Mm-hmm.
But the feeling of the subcommittee when we met was that we wanted to kind of have the business, because it is a business, and I think David Talley had spoke to this during the last workshop, because it is a business, they wanted to recognize that, haven't filled out a checklist, sort of acknowledge that the business is there, which gives them some degree of protection from complaints from neighbors. If our code enforcement administrator gets a phone call and says so-and-so is doing a business on their property, and we say, well, yeah, you know, they filled out a checklist and they're registered business, and they're under this threshold, and therefore we're not going to follow up on any code enforcement complaints unless they exceed that threshold. It just defines what the business might be.
That's exactly
and
what I wanted to hear.
Keep it, you know, low cost, fill out a checklist, you know, it's an over-the-counter,
I read this
put
again
on the list kind of thing.
I read this again last night, and I was thinking, well, why don't we just give them a free pass and not even deal with this? Because I think that's what Margaret was thinking. But then, and I was going to ask you the question, what is the reason for, because I couldn't come up with a reason, but now that you've mentioned the code enforcement, I like that reason, that there is something that somebody, if somebody calls in, you can acknowledge it, and it's there. So I feel better about that now, personally.
I'm not sure that people who have home occupations or might have home occupations or aren't really sure whether it's a hobby or an occupation, I'm not really sure why they would go fork over $50 and fill out a checklist when their neighbors don't even, you know, when by the very nature of an exempt business, their neighbors don't even, there's no reason their neighbors would be aware of it unless they told them. I think the problem with this is that if we require this, we're putting another unenforceable rule on the books that we can't enforce and that people will not comply with voluntarily, and that there's really no reason for it.
I agree with you.
Especially it is unenforceable. I mean, if they meet the general definition and criteria for home occupations, then it would be under 9203L.
Correct.
But how are we going to even know if people are doing something in their own home if they don't, if they're not, you know, if they really meet the qualifications for an exempt business, there's no reason anybody would know. And so that makes it unenforceable just by its very nature.
You see, what I think we should do is say, you don't need to get a permit. You can do it. Nobody's going to know it. And if somebody does know it, you're probably in violation. If you get a complaint, we're going to investigate, and you're going to have to clean it up and get your permit at that point, maybe.
I mean, we can call it a level of exemption if it's under this, or we can call it a registered business. There's, you know, what we were after was you're using residential property for business purposes, and there's got to be some recognition of that, and there's a point at which...
I've got one quick comment. We've moved here 8 years ago. Well, in Portland, my wife was an architectural draftsman, and she continued down here, did all the work at home, nobody comes to see her. We didn't even know there was such a thing as a home occupational license. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of stuff we're looking to license? Is people like attorneys or salespeople or draftsmen that don't have anybody coming here and they're doing all the work on the internet or phone?
Well, that the definition 92030. And 92040. Registered home occupations. You're the resident of the property, you have an exterior signs, you have customers, you have deliveries, you get a business vehicle on site.
Like I was saying, I was originally thinking that the same thing, why even have this? But then you gave me a reason to have it. I don't know, maybe it's not a good enough reason, but I do understand the fact that, you know, maybe there is nothing on the outside that shows that there is a business here, and maybe they meet all the standards. But if they've got an ornery neighbor who knows that they're doing something in there, whether it's an internet business or a draftsperson or whatever, and they want to complain, at least if they call up, the planning and the code officer can say, hey, look, you've got nothing to complain about. They're meeting all the standards. End of discussion.
That's typically what business license. This is just like a business license in Grants Pass.
Yeah, it's like a business license.
Which is $50.
So here's my thing here, is that these define sort of maximum. They don't really say what actually qualifies as doing business. For example, I make videos. I make these documentary videos. I do it for, it's a hobby. But every once in a while, somebody will pay me. Now, the IRS has yet to determine whether it's a business or a hobby because you have to make a profit in 3 out of 5 years for it to be considered a business, and I haven't gotten there yet, so and I'm right between business and hobby.
And you're a hobby.
So,
Dave Church takes photographs. If he sells one to his neighbor, he's not a business, he's a hobby.
So at what point do you say it's a business? How much
when money changes hands?
No, but money changes
hands. Oh, yeah.
I mean,
right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's profitable.
Right.
Because when my expenses exceed my income, then the IRS says, well, your income has to exceed your expenses for 3 out of 5 years. And right now, I'm in the fourth year, and I need to have a profit in 2 more years for them not to be declaring me a hobby. But
I think we could define that threshold, I think. Or we could just say the threshold's undefined, but if you declare yourself a business, then...
Well, I'm trying to declare myself a business with the IRS because I've taken a Section 179 and I'm hoping that I'll get enough profit in the remaining 2 years or a year and a half to do that. But at this point, but you know, there are a lot of people who have hobbies, who make a little money and who may or may not. Now, I might be a business 1 year and a hobby the next. Because I may exceed my limit of years without a profit. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those nebulous things.
Well, I think if somebody came to, if we got a code enforcement call, and Nanette goes out there, and sure enough, the guy's building, I think he built birdhouses last time. Mm-hmm. The guy's building a few birdhouses, he sells them, he's got a little sign up that says birdhouses, $20. And she goes out there, and he comes back in and says, well, you know, I sold 5 birdhouses this year for $20 a piece. Is he a business? No. Not by the IRS definition, not by a reasonable person's definition, is he a business? No.
So what the IRS doesn't actually have a dollar limit on what makes you a business.
So.
But is he making a profit at $100?
So it could be by all or not.
He may or may not be. If he grows his own trees and cuts his own trees, and, you know.
He pays us $50.
But that's the thing. Why should he have to pay $50? Because he might, by somebody's definition, be a business.
He has to.
What's the penalty for not being registered?
$50.
I mean, somebody like my wife, we didn't know anything about that. How does the county get the word out to people? You know, and so somebody complains and code enforcement goes out there and say, you're not registered, and go, I didn't know.
Right. So typically, when anyone has a code violation, yeah. The first thing is come down and get your permit.
Yeah. Okay, that's a law.
I got to confess, I was a licensed general contractor for some 20 years, and I never knew I was supposed to get a business license. I had my pickup truck and a trailer, and I had piles of scrap lumber that I would reuse here and there.
Well, we've heard all that through the photographs.
Well, if you live in Johnson County, you don't have to get a business license. There
but
is no
well,
business
actually,
license.
If you do any contracting in Grants Pass, then you do actually
yeah,
right.
Right. Right. I gave it back because I got frustrated with their process. But anyway, I didn't mean a business. I mean a home occupation. I mean, right. I would qualify as I should have gotten a home occupation permit, it sounds like.
Now, I had a home occupation permit, and I knew about it back in 97.
Well, you're more aware.
Pretty much any county you go has one. Just mm-hmm. People don't think about it.
Yeah. I've had a home occupation permit as well for a photography business.
But we get calls often from people asking what's the business license process in the county.
Yeah. I just think that it's such a gray area. And how do you, and when you've been, you know, assuming that nobody ever complains, that nobody ever knows it's there, why should somebody have to pay $50 to register? So, you know, and then just in case somebody might complain at some point in the future, you can say, oh, well, they're registered. Well, if the person's complaining, obviously they're exceeding what an exempt business would be, and they're going to need to be investigated whether they're registered or not.
Not
so
true.
So what good does it do?
Not true, especially in this county.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because there's too many freaking busybodies that want to know what the hell you're doing on your property, and they just sit there and watch you. And doesn't matter whether you're doing anything wrong or not.
And they bring cookies over to share and then look around the kitchen to make sure you're not selling jam.
So,
but you know what?
I understand your thinking, but I disagree with it wholeheartedly because I've seen it.
Okay, but listen, what about this? You don't charge them $50. You don't have them registered. They're exempt. And if somebody calls and complains, the enforcement officer can still say, well, what is it they're doing? And she says, oh, well, they're cooking jam in their kitchen, and I'm just pretty sure they're smuggling it out during the night or something. Go, well, sorry, that doesn't qualify. That's
right.
Okay.
That does not mean anything. The
main purpose of this is to create a threshold. Now, what you do below that threshold of needing a Type 1 home occupation is up to you.
Well, we could still go back to the...
You can call it exempt.
We could call these are exempt, and give them a free pass. Just say, this is
right.
The standard
anything
for
below
exemption.
Type 1, I think
if you don't meet this threshold, you don't have to register, and you don't have to pay a fee.
Exactly. That's what I would like to say.
That's what I would like to
say.
It's going to be up to the whole commission.
I would leave it how it is.
Folks.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. Let me add this.
You can do that. I mean, we're going to hearing with something. And,
yeah.
And
right, but any...
Let's call it...
Whether they're...
For the hearing.
Whether they've done the application or not done the application, the county is still going to have an expense involved if there's a complaint. Right?
Yes, but we've just decided that people will complain regardless. I mean,
right. But,
you know, people will complain even if you don't have a...
It's better to have the county get $50 to have to monitor a complaint than not.
Frankly, that's what most business license revenue is for.
Yeah.
That's for monitoring the folks that are
out of bounds.
Well, how
about charge the fee to the person who files the complaint, the specious complaint? Someone files a complaint and their complaint is not justified, they get charged the fee.
I have the exact same suggestion written in my notes.
Right.
You pay $50, and if your complaint is justified, you get it back. And if it's not, you lose $50.
The difference having registered businesses would make if someone calls into our office and says, I want to make a complaint about this, and we look it up on Laserfish right there and say, they have a registered business. And as long as they're staying within these standards, they're not in violation. And if we don't have a registered business, the difference is that Nan would have to start writing letters and hope to get a visit to the property.
Yeah, that,
well, actually, I disagree.
And that is the important.
That's exactly what would happen.
But if the
that
man calls,
that's the process.
But here's the thing: if the man calls up and says, "I have a complaint," and you say, "Well, what are they doing?" and he says, "Well, they're doing this, this, and this." If those things fall under Type 1, it doesn't, if whether the business is registered or not, they don't. They're okay. Then you say, listen, that doesn't meet the minimum criteria for a Type 1 business, so we're not going to investigate that. If the man says they're doing this and they've got three cars with signs on them and I can see that they have people coming in and out, then you say, okay, they're not registered and that's a Type 1 criteria, and so we're going to go investigate that. But if it doesn't meet the Type 1 criteria, you don't investigate. It doesn't matter for it.
How many? Let me see how I word this question.
That is how the exempt would work. Yes.
But I mean, you don't need to be registered to do that.
Right.
What percentage of complaint calls are fielded by NAN?
100%,
80%, 50%? Does she go out? Any
of the not calls. It has to be a signed complaint.
Okay. Right.
She starts writing letters, and the hopeful way that it goes is that she will get a response from the property owner agreeing to let her come to the property so that they can discuss and see if the violation is even existent or if it's...
Okay. So what I'm going at is we, as a planning department, are going to have time and money invested in every single complaint that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
What's going to save the county the most money?
Having charging for spurious complaints.
Yeah, it will. The other thing, excuse me if I'm wrong, one of you guys can tell me, is it still the case where I can't just call and make a complaint? I've got a sign, and they will know who complained, right?
Yes.
So somebody's not going to come in and just sign randomly, I wouldn't think, unless there's actually something to complain about.
Yeah, you know, that usually separates the people that are serious from the people that just want to call and use the county as their bulldog, so to speak.
Yeah.
So that's, when they have to sign it, that's when they get... they think twice, and
you're going to start a neighborhood too.
There are rare cases, though, maybe not so rare, where it becomes a neighborhood war. You turned me in. Now I'm going to be watching you, and whatever you do, I'm going to turn you in. We had one gentleman who was so upset about being turned in, he drove through the county, and with his complaint sheets and his camera, and wherever he found a complaint, and started turning them in.
Remember Red Mountain Golf Course? Neighbors, they didn't come to the planning beforehand when they wanted to move a road in the golf course, and it was perfectly within their right to do so, but the guy had an easement, and he got mad because they moved the road, and sheriffs, cops, everybody got involved in that one.
Do we have some consensus on whether we want to call this
for consensus?
A threshold that's exempt or registered or...
I prefer
to take a hearing.
Well, here's... In a nutshell, just as an example, somebody calls up and says, I have a complaint about my neighbor. I think they're running a business. And you say, assuming that they're, you look up their registered business, and you say, okay, what's your complaint? They say the complaint, you say, well, they're registered business, and that does not meet the Type 1, so we don't need to investigate that. Thank you for calling. Okay, they call up, and you look up, and they're not a registered business, and you touch the complaint. It's the exact same complaint. They still don't meet the criteria for a Type 1 business.
Mm-hmm.
Then wouldn't we still say the exact same thing? Well, they don't meet the criteria for a Type 1 business, so there's no complaint. Thank you for calling. So since the result's the same in both cases, why do we need to have everybody pay... why do we need to have a requirement that everybody pays $50 if they have a hobby that might be a business or a business that might be a hobby... And when there's actually no difference in the actual implementation.
Well, the difference is that the county has the $50 to handle the phone call, but I don't see that it's fair. I don't see that it's fair that somebody that's not violating the business has to pay
$50. Sometimes it does cost $50 to answer a phone call. I'll pay that right now.
Well, I would say
further calls.
But I would say if
you shut the person down, say it's registered,
But
tell your neighbors.
But you can shut them down by saying they meet the standards for an exempt business. This is not something that requires a permit because because these are the standards. Unless they're violating these standards, they don't need a permit for this.
That does not always shut them down.
But now here's the other thing. If you say when, see, we're saying in case somebody files a spurious complaint, we want to charge the property owner ahead of time in the event that someone might file a spurious complaint against them. Now, why not turn that around and say if somebody files a spurious complaint, they have to pay. When they file a complaint, if the complaint turns out to be spurious, they're going to have to pay and let them know exactly what the criteria are so that they won't file.
Yeah. So are you suggesting that when someone turns in a complaint form that they're giving $50 over?
Mm-hmm. And they get it back if it's found to be, if it's a legitimate complaint?
I don't know. Throw a wet blanket on what could be a legitimate idea, but the Planning Commission hasn't got the authority to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, legal.
Who does? It's
Board of Commissioners.
That's true.
You could make a recommendation with your recommended ordinance for something like that. Yes.
Because the thing is, I won't vote for charging people $50 to register what might or might not be a business or might not be a hobby, because most people aren't going to do it. And then people are in violation of a law they never knew about, and why should people pay $50?
I'm with Peggy, you know.
Absolutely nothing.
I would also add that, you know, part of the purpose I think that we're trying to do here is to make it more amenable to people where they will register for businesses, because we've got 80% or 85% of the people in the county now that don't. So why make it harder?
But why would we make it harder for people who are already having issues with a neighbor? That it's a difficult situation, and I mean, some people really do are undergoing a hardship for their property value or even just enjoyment of the property they've invested in, and then add insult to injury by charging them $50 in order to come make a legitimate complaint.
I agree with you, Valerie.
Until that point,
except they can get their money back if it's a legitimate complaint.
But some people don't even have that.
All right, well, then how about charge the $50 once it's determined to be spurious?
That would be hard to
spurious complaint.
If somebody'd like to write up the language, I would suggest this at this point. If somebody wants to write up the language about the $50 charge for a complaint, I'd do so, introduce it at the hearing maybe, and if that wants to be recommended and go along to the board, then fine. But the Planning Commission hasn't got jurisdiction to make that call. So.
Okay.
And I'm okay with that, but as a past home occupation permit holder, I don't have a problem with $50 to run a business out of my house.
Well, I don't either.
If I'm running a business, I can afford $50 to be registered with the county.
But what's a business? I mean, somebody
if you can't afford $50,
you're not running a business.
Well,
but see, I think your argument doesn't hold any water, because we can define a business fairly easily.
All right, so how do you define what is the minimum qualification for who needs to pay the $50?
If you're registering, you pay.
Yeah, but what is the minimum that you need to make?
I don't care what minimum.
Can we get a consensus, maybe just really quickly here? I was on the fence, and I'm still a little bit on the fence, but after listening to the discussion, I've been leaning towards the proposal that was submitted by staff to register and pay the $50.
If you're a business, it's to your benefit to register.
But how do you define a business? This does not define. Part of my problem is it defines the minimum qualification for who has to register. People will not know whether they have to register or not, and most people will not register, just like they aren't now. And the problem is we are creating people who are in violation of a law that they don't know exists, and they haven't done anything wrong.
And I will tell you unequivocally, if you go in front of a judge, ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Yes, but why create?
I've been told that before.
Yes, but it's wrong for government to create new laws that people will be in violation of without their knowledge, whether a judge will uphold it or not. It is wrong. It's not ethical.
But I disagree, because I don't think we're creating anything that shouldn't. One, it's already there.
Ron, how do you feel?
Well, business is aware there's an exchange of money for a service or a product.
But what if they don't make? What if they never make a profit?
They're still conducting the business.
Not according to the IRS.
Well, we're not going by the IRS. We're going by whatever we want in the county.
These are land use rules.
Okay, if my kid has a lemonade stand and money is exchanged, I have to pay $50 to the county, even though she only makes 25 cents a month.
That would be a hobby unless you were standing out on the street every day.
No. He said if this money is exchanged hands at the business.
I think you're being petty.
No, I'm
saying common sense would have to come into play.
Well, but you cannot write laws and ordinances on common sense, because everyone's common sense is different. If you cannot define the minimum requirements, you cannot have a law requiring people to pay money to if they don't even know what the minimum requirements are that they need to pay money for.
And
you can't do that.
We're going to continue this with the...
How do you feel,
though? I feel just pretty much exactly as Peggy does. So...
Well, it sounds like we got a difference of opinion here.
I don't
think
we should create more government regulations to put more people on the spot. That, I mean, we should be trying to simplify
it. And I don't believe that we should have the county having all the effort and time invested in the planning department and not getting anything out of this process.
But if
that's how we got in this fiscal crunch in the first place.
Well, the problem,
they're doing all this.
Yes, but we're charging
the
wrong people.
No.
If the county's expense comes when somebody makes a complaint, we don't charge somebody on the supposition that someday somebody might or might not make a complaint. We charge the person who's actually costing the money, which is the person making the complaint, not the person who is having a hobby that some neighbor might consider a business.
And I don't have an issue with that. I'd love to see you write that up and we'll submit it, and I'll support it 100%. I'm still going to say, if you're running a business out of your house,
how
you should have an occupation.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate with Peggy for just a second, because I see maybe a solution. Maybe. The person doesn't call down and register as a business because they don't know that they have to, or they don't think it's a business. Everybody's happy until somebody complains, and then the county can say, hey, you better come down and register as a business, or... Just if you tell us you're not a business, then okay. You know, somebody can prove you're doing something that's a business. Just one other possibility.
And that's all I have to do.
There's plenty of things going on under the radar, and it's not an issue until it becomes an issue for somebody.
The NIMBY. Okay. Well, Steph, I'm not sure we've given you a whole slew of good guidance here.
Need a split vote, sort of.
Well, you know, hey, I'm all for the three of you, so if we have a full complement of there's no votes about it, but we have a full complement of members at the hearing, then I don't even have a vote on this.
Okay.
And in any case, I'll probably be
I think we, I do think we have heard everybody, a lot of good ideas about this,
right.
And I think we have... hashed it over really well. And
I think
everyone understands.
I think what I'd like to get out of you, and obviously there's going to be some discussion and some difference of opinion about whether we call it registered or home or exempt, but as far as the definition of that threshold in 92040,
mm-hmm.
Do we have some
comments? I read 92040 and I don't see any minimum threshold. I don't see anything that defines the minimum qualifications for a business. How do you determine if the guy building birdhouses is a business or a hobby according to 92040?
Got to find out if he's building them for spotted owls or hummingbirds.
Well, he doesn't have a business vehicle on the site. He's not having deliveries to the property. A friend might come over and buy a birdhouse. Is that
then
a customer
business
property? But so you're only a business if you meet all of these qualifications. So you have to have a business vehicle on your property and have customers coming to your property.
You meet all of them, but if you don't meet any of them, then you're not a business.
Well, what if
you
meet some but not all? Are you a business?
This is a threshold where if you exceed 92040, then you are a type 1. That's
right.
The threshold.
That's the reason
and
for defining the threshold.
And if you don't exceed it, how do you know if you're a business or not?
Maybe you're not.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that
would
be
such a gray area.
It'd be
that I think if you don't meet the criteria for a type 1 business,
you've made
you
your point. Well,
it
can call an exempt.
It becomes the choice of whoever's doing the activity.
Right.
You know?
There may be a benefit too. I know there was a benefit to me when.
I mean,
are you going to pay it?
Well, it's like this.
For getting
okay,
no tax write-off.
I look at this. I go, well, I'm not a business. And then 6 months later, my neighbor calls because there's cars coming to the property and coming out with packages or whatever. And so the county calls and you know, this is just a hobby. Well, how often you do this? I mean, there's got to be some way to deal with it.
I think with the intelligence behind this counter, that threshold can be judged accurately.
I don't like leaving it up to some... See, there's the thing. Then the law is not applied equally to everybody. If it's based on the judgment of who happens to be behind the camera when the phone call comes in, that's not equal justice under the law. Some people are going to be charged for something that other people are not going to be charged for something. I just don't think that you can... That unless you can clearly define the minimum threshold for what requires this registration, then I cannot vote for having it. If you can define a minimum criteria that is reasonable and equitable and applies in all cases, then I might vote for this.
If you don't meet any of them, you are an exempt home occupation.
Your hobby.
No, if you meet all of these, I mean, if you exceed any of these, then you're a type 1.
There's no question about that.
Right. Right.
If you're under all of them, or if you're under any one of them, or if you're under
combination. All of them, I would say, from the way it's written. So, in other words, if you exceed any one of them, you're automatically kicked up into a type 1.
Mm-hmm.
So,
if you exceed any one of them, you're already a type 1?
That's what I'm interpreting what it says.
If you exceed any one of them, then you're a type 1.
Right.
If you don't exceed any of them, how do you determine whether you're a business?
You're not.
Well, then why do you have to register if you're not a business?
You could be a business making money and still not exceed these.
Yeah,
but that's the thing. We're saying there's a criteria for type 1. I think we're going to have to move on to the next agenda item.
Because we just keep rehashing the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Same
issues. I just.
Anybody want coffee? I'm on the way.
Okay. So, and looking at you also, we are through with this list of workshop topics. You wanted to talk about fees as well, or any of these other issues.
Let's go to another topic real quick. How about definitions?
Okay, definitions would be good.
That's what we're talking about.
Oh, maybe this will help us.
Presences and what that
means. What's a definition?
Is this the new one?
No, well, I did include a new copy, but it hasn't changed.
Okay.
That's actually what I'm going to do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Definition. That's what we currently have.
This is the current definition.
No, this is our new definition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Are
you talking 92.0 or something?
No, there's a sheet
with
definitions.
There's a page called definitions. I know, I've seen it. I just got to find it.
And it's paraphrased in there, if you look at it. And also accessory living quarters.
So this is not viewed as basically as receiving remuneration, which is what Ron said. So,
whether the IRS thinks so or not.
But that would still include a lemonade stand.
Customers are coming to a lemonade stand.
That's true. You're type 1 if you're a lemonade stand.
Well, you really want to equate a lemonade stand with an auto body repair business.
We can add a lemonade stand in with the garage. Help us define what the threshold is rather than just critiquing. What level qualifies as a business? This is why I'm saying that anything below a type 1 should simply be exempt, because we sitting at this table, we can't come
does
up with
type, does type 1 and does this definition of home occupation satisfy your need for a more defined definition of your business? And if not, help us do it.
It defines a home occupation, but I still think that it does not, the problem is it still includes a lemonade stand. And if you have to pay $50 for a lemonade stand, now you can say that's not common sense. But if the law is not common sense, it's a bad law. You can't say it's up to the interpretation of the law to provide the common sense.
Then let's get a definition.
And
All I'm hearing from you is objection to what we have, rather than helping us...
And that's why I say... We cannot have a definition that I can think of that will make this reasonable and equitable, and therefore anything under type 1 should be exempt. And if someone can come up with a definition that's reasonable and equitable and provides a floor...
How about if we say lemonade stands are exempt?
They're going to be under short-term sales.
Something like that, and say that's similar, 92, small business, especially run by children.
Lemonade stands will be there.
All right, but we still have birdhouses. We still have. I don't know if.
I don't care. You're running a business.
I don't know.
It's a home occupation. You've got a great definition right there.
I occasionally make videos and occasionally, you know, get paid for them. I don't know if that qualifies me as a business. If I don't know, and I'm on the planning commission, how does Joe Schmo out in the county know?
Do these birdhouses meet this home occupation definition?
That somebody sometimes remunerates me. Well, if you sell one birdhouse every 5 or 10 years, then you're a business.
There's
maybe you're a short-term sale.
Yeah, I just look at short-term sales. That solves the lemonade stand.
We put the short-term sales in here as an addendum or in addition to this definition. Say
it's only here.
It's here.
It's 92090.
Short-term sales, and here's a definition. Such sales, you're not exceeding 40 days a year, you're allowed to do stuff on your property. Sales is in there. So if I sell 40 videos per year, assuming I could make that many, and I sell less than 40 days a year, then I can be considered a short-term sales. Now, what if I make $50,000 selling those short-term sales?
I guess it doesn't matter.
As long as it meets this definition.
The IRS might care, but we don't care.
How you file your taxes will determine that.
Well, that seems pretty odd to me.
I think you're making the argument, Margaret, that any financial remuneration is a business. I think we're trying to define it as something other than that. So you haven't given us a definition of what a business might be.
No, I think this definition is fine.
And now, on the other hand, making $50,000 doing a hobby, I think, isn't really called a hobby anymore.
Right.
But you don't want to call that a business either.
No, I'm just saying that according to this definition, the $50,000 one, you could apply the same short-term sales rule to that. You could apply to a lemonade stand and make that exempt too. So what I'm saying is that I'm fine with all of this. I really am. The only thing that I have any problem with at all is charging someone $50 to be exempt.
And I have no problem with that at all. I paid it. I had my occupation permit.
But I think there are a lot of people who are not going to know whether they're a business or whether they're a hobby.
Okay.
And they have to
make it voluntary.
I actually don't have an agenda. I didn't have this, but I don't have it. Protocol, are we on that?
We left the protocol behind.
Oh, we left protocol. We missed protocol.
Yeah, your permission's missing.
Are there any other comments on the definitions?
I think the definition is very crisp.
I like them.
I think so. All the definitions work for me.
Business critical. It's about retail sales. Incidental retail sales is one that comes up in a lot of home occupational businesses. And the shampoo sale is the classic example. But and that's another one of those, to be honest with you. Fuzzy lines. Well, what's incidental retail sales? We have a home occupation right now that a gentleman is proposing. I think Roger's written a thing on it. He's doing reloading supplies, and he does firearms training classes. People don't have their actual pistol on his site at his home, but they come in and they go through the paperwork and he shows videos and that sort of thing. I think he does have an unloaded firearm he uses as a demonstration. He's
teaching the firearm safety.
Yeah. No one's actually shooting on the property. He also sells reloading supplies. And the question we had was that incidental to the firearms classes and things like that? And we determined that that's an incidental sales. He's going to make more money off training classes, and he also trains competition shooters. Than he will on the reloading supplies. But he wanted to have a sign up and have some stock in a room, and he talked to the fire marshal and he talked to the building official about having separation, so if he has a fire in the building, it's not going to create 4th of July on his block. And
so he's doing it for his advantage.
What's that?
He's doing it for his advantage as a business. Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of calls that we make.
And generally we do it in favor of the business as long as any potential mitigation or impacts to the neighbors might be mitigated. In his case, we said park the cars this way. Basically, the headlights come in at night, and if you've got four or five cars parked in front for people attending a class, then we park away from that. And I think we put up a fence or something like that for screening.
I think in the
incidental sales, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. And what is that point where the sign goes up and there's more retail than there is incidental? There's more shampoo being sold than haircuts, let's say. Hard to say.
Oh, so what?
It just doesn't.
What is the?
What's the
significance
are?
Of whether the sales are incidental or part of the main business? Is there any significance in terms of permitting or what classification?
Is a grocery store a home occupation? No, it's retail sales.
So you can't have if your home occupation is retail sales. Then that's not an okay home occupation.
It might not be allowed.
It isn't allowed. Somebody has, I'm sorry to keep being the devil's advocate.
Under the current ordinance.
It's now permitted under the Type 3.
Type 3.
I have a neighbor who raises chickens. Now let's say that they had more eggs than they could eat in their family, and they decided to sell some of them. They're not doing anything else, so it's not ancillary to any other home occupation. Would that then?
One of the questions we've had, I don't know if we have a good definition of this. Frankly, we've even contemplated is what constitutes retail, because in the marketing in the business world, Ron knows this. You get wholesale and you get retail. They have different customer levels. They have different traffic levels usually associated with them. ABC do retail or wholesale? Okay. And how does that distinction show up in how you run your business?
Well, when you're doing retail, you know, it's any Joe Schmo that walks in the door, or it's almost always generically local.
Right.
When you're doing the wholesale, it's almost always non-local. Okay. Whether it be internet or somebody's driving in, Ashland, Brookings, wherever.
How would you characterize the difference in signage, parking, hours, and things like that?
For the retail, it'd all be retail. You wouldn't do it for wholesale. You wouldn't advertise it. Because on a wholesale level or something of that nature, you're dealing specifically with other people of your nature. So they're going to know who you are. So your advertising doesn't need to happen. They're not going to be walking down the street looking for somebody. They know who you are. They're going to be trying to find you, and as soon as they see the name, they'll know who you are. Now, if it's just Mo walking in to buy a cup of coffee or something, a name's not necessarily going to trigger it for them.
Right.
And the volume on the retail side is going to be, I'd say, generically probably 70% or better.
So getting back to Peggy's question about the farm stands or the egg sales, which is farm
egg
stands.
Egg sales is agricultural. It would not come under home occupation.
It would fall under this similar and permitted and outright uses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it shouldn't be a problem there.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And it'd be a hobby if they're selling, you know, a dozen eggs a month or something.
Yeah.
If you look at the list, and I think we sent this out at the first workshop, if you look at the list of currently permitted home occupations.
Oh, yeah.
We can find any farm sales on it.
Okay. Good question. We're talking about definitions. I've got stuff in the definitions on this draft. And this thing here that I got tonight is totally different. Am I missing something? Which one are we looking at?
These are the ones that we were proposing to put in there.
These are?
Yeah.
To put in addition to these?
Mm-hmm.
This is just a general definition. This is what would go in the definition section of the code.
1103.
Okay.
So that it could be referenced.
Right.
So this won't go into the code?
Yes, this will go into the code as Article 92.
Oh,
this would go into Article 11 under definition.
Okay, gotcha, thanks.
But they support items in here.
Yeah, if we think the definitions are like wireless, they're very specific to wireless. You really don't, you know, there's nothing as a sector array elsewhere in the code. There's not such thing as co-location elsewhere in the code. So those would stay in Article 99. But if it may have application elsewhere in the code, such as incidental retail sales, then we put them in Section 11.
Okay, I have a couple of issues with the definitions then.
Okay. Go for it.
this one's pretty simple. It says you've got to, operations have to comply with current noise levels. Noise ordinance, I didn't know there was anything in a noise ordinance.
Are you on definition?
This isn't a definition. This is a standard.
This is a general definition.
This is the A is the general definition.
Okay.
Okay. And then following that is the general criteria.
Oh, okay.
Where are we here?
The first page.
Number one. First page of the Article 92.
92.
Okay. Okay, well, then I have a term. I have some
just
questions
saying,
about
are
the
these
criteria.
All definitions here or not? That's the general definition. These are the criteria.
Oh, okay.
The criteria is that they have to follow a current noise ordinance. I didn't know there was one, and I don't think it's ever enforced anyway from what I've heard.
There is a current noise ordinance. It is very vague.
Well, I know I was citing a rock quarry, and what came out at all the hearings, which there were seven, was DEQ is the only one that can enforce it, and they won't. They don't have any money.
But whether they have money to enforce, if it is an ordinance, it's an ordinance.
If it is an ordinance, it is. Okay, I didn't know. That's fine.
The ordinance basically says don't make noise.
Okay.
Don't bother people with noise.
And then this is another one that's kind of similar to a lot of issues I have here. It's like no exterior remodeling which alters the residential character of the structure. Well, again, to me, if you can't see the structure from your neighbor's property or the road, who cares? Why can't we add... Okay, look, let me see. Page... 92060.
It doesn't care for the structure. It's just about everything except if you built a, if you built a 50-foot tower or something like that.
Oh, building a storage shed in the front yard.
What's that?
Building
a storage shed could be residential.
Sure.
Unless it's a warehouse.
Yeah.
Well, there's a section here, 92060A7 and A9. Which say storage materials on site to be screened from view of neighboring properties by a solid fence, adequate vegetation or other structures. Why not just put that into this criteria?
Because we don't want them all to have to build a fence.
And because not all parcels are 10 acres.
And it looks like a garage. Fine. If your garage suddenly becomes a 6,000-square-foot building that's 50 feet tall, it's not a garage.
What if it's a 6,000? Well, what if it's a okay, what if it's a 6,000-foot building that's only 8 feet tall and nobody even knows it's there? What difference does it make?
What about just changing that to add without the proper building permits?
Is your problem design review, like you just don't like to be told how to design your house so it has a, quote, residential character? Is that what the issue is?
I don't even have a dog in this fight. I'll never build another house.
I'm just trying
to keep this, make it too intrusive.
I agree with you. I think that's very restrictive. And if you want to build something to a point, as long as you get the permits, I don't see why they couldn't.
Well, especially if you can't see it from
with proper
house.
Permits.
Right, that makes sense.
Well, but if you say you just got to have proper permits, then you're throwing this rule out the window because somebody could build some monstrous house.
But they're still going to be restricted by the code.
It could be 50 cars a day. That would alter the residence.
Now, this is exterior remodeling, and I'm inclined to agree with you, Malcolm, that, maybe that is getting into the area of design review. And, even with proper permits, you can build aesthetically anything you want, just about.
Yep.
Whatever suits your fancy. If you want to build a tower, build a tower, as long as it's structurally sound, meets the setback and height requirements.
He gets the permit.
You know?
That's right.
The permitting process won't let you build a 600,000-foot warehouse on your property. So I think I like
No,
the
because there's building size requirements.
Yeah.
What's the building size you can build?
6,000.
Okay. So I know this. Am I hearing maybe we should strike number two?
Well, do you strike it or just say without proper permits?
And the proper permits are required.
Well,
the only thing in the ORS that touches at all on this, and it might be a stretch, but in ORS 215448, it says nothing in this section authorizes the governing body or its designate to permit construction of any structure that would not otherwise be allowed in the zone in which the home occupation is to be established. Right. So that's basically saying you're not going to have a factory.
Yeah.
This language may be more restrictive, may seem more restrictive, but that's the general tone of it, is that you're not creating a an industrial yard in a residential area.
Would we want to make this reference to the statute then?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
That makes sense.
That, I mean, that's a threshold. But
okay. This is like you can't, the residential character of the structure, you put up a wind vane, you changed your character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a little restrictive.
Well, that's what I was getting at.
Well,
design review. If you built your house and it looks like a McDonald's with a golden arches out front.
Yeah, but we've done a lot of QUDs with the...
But
on the other hand, it isn't illegal to do that.
What if you're Andy Warhol and you think that's art?
We've done enough CC&Rs to know what you can do.
No, and there are restrictions in the building code. I built a workshop one time. They said, no, you can't use that shop grade 211 siding. Well, why not? So, because it's ugly. I'm going, who cares? Nobody can see it. I'm on 43 acres.
We got to use
you know,
OSB
standard or better. No, you had to use T111 that was better grade. I thought I'm painting that. Who cares?
Okay, so I hear we're going to refer to the ORS on this one then.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
Okay. Malcolm, you look like you had a whole list of things that you want to keep
doing.
Are you on a roll?
I got to tell my wife that we're going to be here a while.
Hopefully
I like that ring.
Yeah, I think it's
on there. That was supposed to be.
Could we vote on that before Sunday?
Yeah.
Maybe we don't want to be here.
Get the vote. How long are we going to be here anyway?
I heard 7:30, but.
15 minutes.
I told her maybe 8.
25 minutes, actually.
Well, are you going to try to wrap it up at 7:30, or do we have a set time?
I don't think I know. Well, we'd be done if you stop putting that thing down. Get back to the program.
You don't know what list you have.
I just learned to text yesterday.
What's that thing about? Well, Malcolm was working on his
Oh, comments. I thought you were still working on what are we going
to do. No, we're going to refer back to the ordinance.
We're waiting on you.
All right, sorry.
Is that picked up there? Put that down. We're going to make reference to the statute.
Oh, there's one thing that this isn't really covered. It sort of is. It's just the water situation, adequate water. I wonder if we should point out somewhere that if you have a commercial business of any kind, you have a maximum exemption of 5,000 gallons of water a day, whether it's a factory or a home, what you call it, B&B. And the only way you can get around it is to file for water rights, and it's hard to do.
That's not our rules, but what we do notice to agencies.
It's not our rules.
It's Oregon Water Resources,
and they're the
it's
in the RLDC.
Is it?
Absolutely. That way, I think I'm right.
Okay. But
everything's falling apart.
Do we need it in the home occupation or not? Excuse me.
Well, it's just like, okay, we're going to do a B&B.
Change, and if it's in our ordinance and the state changes the rule.
Yeah, here it is. It's 84.020. But like if you've got a B&B, somebody says, okay, cool, I'm going to put in 5 rooms and have 10 guests every night. Well, that's a lot of people using a lot of water. I think most people wouldn't know that that's an issue. I don't.
How would you determine that? You think that would be over 5,000 gallons? I mean, have we determined if it was 4,900 or 5,100?
This is a comment that I get from the water master whenever I notice their stuff.
Yeah, I don't think we need to have it in multiple places. We've already got it in the state statutes and the RLDC. We put it someplace else, and it becomes a nightmare.
Right, exactly. It does say commercial purpose. So.
Number 9 under 92.110, it says the inn, and this is referring to bed and breakfast, the inn must meet all applicable county and state water, sewage, and licensing requirements.
Mentioning 5,000 gallons is the most you're allowed to use.
But that could change, and if that changes, then...
There's catch-all provisions. It's just a program.
In the interest of saving time, I'm not going to argue that anymore.
Can I ask a question? When somebody goes, okay, I'm going to have a bed and breakfast, what about building codes?
5 bedrooms.
Huh?
5 bedrooms.
5 bedrooms.
Plus the owner.
But I mean, what about... You know, they don't have a handrail on the stairs, or they got
bars. You're under
the residential code, and that's why the 5-bedroom provision is there, which makes it a little difficult when we're looking at tree houses as bed and breakfasts because they're a little different in many ways. But if your 5 bedrooms are under for rent, leasable bedrooms, you get your own bedroom and then 5 to rent. You're covered under the residential portion of the building code.
Are you told it'll be a while? Let's see.
Joining us late is Tommy Drake.
Yeah. Answer that was Tweety Bird.
Go ahead. Keep going.
There's several places in here that talk about 10-foot setback from property lines for signs. I would rather say on the property and not on the county right away. If you're going to have a sign, why not make it visible?
That's a standard for commercial. Our commercial setback is 10 feet, and that is why we typically, in residential zones, have a 30-foot setback.
As for signs?
Yes. Well, there's a 30-foot setback from the right-of-way for any structure or sign in the residential zone. And because they are trying to do a commercial use, we thought that they should be able to have their sign seen, so we changed it to the commercial standard, which is 10 feet.
Okay.
Yeah, see, does that, the residential, that doesn't apply to for sale signs, does it? Because they're always right out there.
Those are temporary signs.
They're temporary.
There's also permanent signs, including billboards, that are actually in the county right of way that have been complained about, and nobody's done anything about it.
But that's where we came up with that number.
Okay.
It's from a commercial.
Are we okay with the 10-foot setbacks?
Yeah.
Okay, we're fine.
Anything else?
Yeah.
If you jump again.
No, I mentioned this last time. Oh, you've already gone through this on the number of vehicles. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's stuff in here about the garage sales and the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, being exempt.
Yeah. Boy, I can tell you that back in the late 70s, there was an attempt made to regulate garage sales, and there were thousands of people turning out just absolutely furious. I don't know if there's any rules about that anymore, but maybe saying you can't have more than 4 days in duration and occur more than four times in the calendar year.
10 times.
Are these new rules or are these current rules?
These are new.
These are new, okay.
There have been issues, and I don't know if you remember when Nan brought these up, but people are actually having just a garage sale where it never goes away.
Absolutely. That's what was happening in the 70s.
Right.
There was a place in Wilderville, and the businesses in town, the second-hand stores, were just going berserk because they're going, they don't have to do anything, and it just got really contentious. So just be aware of that.
It could be contentious, but you don't have a problem with the 4 days 10 times.
I don't know where the numbers came from, but I don't.
The subcommittee voted.
Okay, then I'm not going to fight it. I just wanted to point out there could be some real issues.
Everybody else okay on that?
I'm okay with
that. Because I recall we had one contingent that said we wanted one per month, and then another contingent said 6 times a year, and I think they
came up
sort of in the middle and came up
compromised with 10. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Sullivan, you don't see too many December, January. 6 times a year, even if you have it on the weekend, Friday or Saturday and Sunday is still only, you know.
Here's just a question. I'm not sure what this means on the 92-110 on the bed and breakfast, number one. The inn must be located in a resident or accessory living quarters. And then number two, it says the owner must live on the premises and continue to use part of the structure as a residence. Does that mean the owner can live in either one?
Operator. It says operator.
I'm sorry. So,
And that's,
you're looking at
that's there for a purpose. We have some people that will start a bed and breakfast generally as a retirement business. Mm-hmm. And when they get old, you know, retirement plus age, mm-hmm. like 75 or 80,
careful.
They typically want to have someone else operate the bed and breakfast. We don't want the bed and breakfast to go away just because people are too old to live there anymore and run it.
Oh, so you'd like that. Yeah. Good. But my question was, where does the operator or the owner have to live? In the accessory living quarters or the structure itself, the main structure, or either one?
The main structure would still have to be a residence. An accessory structure is not a residence. It's an accessory to the residence.
Okay. So they have to live in part of the structure.
Cabins, tree.
So maybe it should say the main structure or something.
Or the residence. Yeah, part of.
I'll put the residence.
Okay.
Okay.
Makes sense.
This is another one that's similar to some other complaints, I guess. It's the inn will be compatible with the neighborhood in terms of blah, blah, blah. And.
Right. Which number are you on?
I'm sorry, number five.
Okay.
It sounds like we want it to be look just like all the rest of the houses, but maybe it wants to look real special because it's a B&B and you can't see it from the neighbor's properties. What difference does it make? I'd refer back to that.
Well, then, if it was
not visible by the other houses, then it probably wouldn't be considered incompatible.
Okay. Good.
It sounds like it's resolved.
Everything else you've already covered.
Right.
I thought I had about four more.
Do any other commissioners have questions, comments, or concerns about the draft ordinance that we're running
through? I've already raised one.
I have a question. Are you going to write up your proposal that David suggested you could write up and submit, or just?
I think you should.
All right, I'll do that.
If it wouldn't be too much of a burden. Because I'd like to read it, too, and maybe it'll change my mind. I don't know, but I'm not saying it will.
You can be persuasive.
You're pretty persuasive.
I will take a stab at that.
Definitely write up the frivolous complaint, and you pay for it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking about that.
Yeah. Okay, staff.
Go to the board, so.
Yeah, but we can submit it to the board.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been here so long without seeing this department. They're really the only one that generates revenue.
Just your information, there is a code enforcement ordinance that's being considered by the board right now. They've actually asked legal to draw up a draft for them. So the board has already requested that.
Raising the fees?
Charging people for serious complaints.
I'm just being...
The board has a tendency to waive that fee.
Yeah,
oh,
when the board waives more fees than anything.
I was thinking about the general lack of revenue and trying to find ways to get more of it.
Yeah, but you're doing it legitimately that way. Because I know, without question, as long as I've been on this commission, that this planning office does a crap load of work they don't get paid for.
Mm-hmm. I would just say that the leverage would be hard to find for that, because when you are charging a surcharge for a violation, then you have the leverage of they have done something against the code. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a major type of violation, then it's going to go down the legal pathway. When it's somebody who has simply complained about something, where's your leverage?
Did you want to talk any more about application and fee outline? We haven't really touched on that yet.
Let's touch on that. That was one of the issues that came up. The subcommittee, when they looked at this, focused on approximate fees that were already in the code and number of hours that are typically spent by staff. And that's... I had hoped at one point that we would kind of walk everybody through exactly what happens and how often we, how much work is involved in some of this stuff. We've got, application fee that comes in. We've got application that's reviewed. We've got, entering it into the system, receiving. We scan things to the property. So if you've got a permit that's applicable to that property, we've got a copy of it available in LaserFish and in our permit tracking system. And we've got, a portion of almost every fee really could be designated as part of the overall code compliance. That's how a code administrator is paid for. So that's where the fees came from. And rather than trying to come up with new ones, in a couple of places what we've done is combine permits, such as the Type 1 standards only, we went to a fee that's already charged. Because doing any adjustment to the fee ordinance itself is a erroneous decision. And it's appealable. And it opens up your entire fee schedule when you do that. The county is still trying to settle a case with Rogue Advocates over the fee schedule. Hmm. Haven't settled it yet, even though we're...
Oh, the appeals, right?
What's well, what's the appeal fees on that? Yeah. What's the question on that? Or what's the dispute about?
On that particular case, it was the amount charged for appeals. But by going to a fee that's already there...
Mm-hmm. Got to do it.
You don't go there. You're not opening up any kind of
can of worms box.
I think what you've done with the Type 1 there, cost $375, same as the current pre-application review, so you've got a fee identified. But what we're not doing is going beyond that and charging a development permit fee that we would normally do. So we're keeping that one, Type 1, pretty cheap. Type 2, where there's more review, there's standards, there's public notice, there's a site visit, we've got some staff time involved there. And the fee that we went to was the current technical plan review of $650. We're generally looking at a set of plans, comparing it to criteria or standards. And again, the development permit fee is included in the cost of the application. And then the conditional use permit fee, now we're getting more complicated. We're going to a public hearing and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I looked at this myself, and I thought these fees, and I think I understood what you were getting at, and I thought they were reasonable considering what I assumed would be the significance of the staff time. That,
right.
That's just general, my thinking.
You know, the general direction we have in the statutes for land use planning fees are you are supposed to charge the actual or average cost of service.
Mm-hmm. We don't do
that. Review.
What are we at, 50%?
What's that?
What do we charge, 50%?
For some of the fees, I would say we probably are charging the average cost of service. We don't do an actual. We are thinking of going to that for comp plan and zone changes. Let's face it, the Whitaker application, we lost money, big time. And that's because the Planning Commission had several hearings, the board had several hearings, there were lots of changes along the way. The Warren Weaver was another one where we lost money. We certainly did. The citizens picked up the tab for that one. And what we're trying to do is if you're after development, you're paying the cost of the review process. One of the things that we're trying to do, obviously, is make some of the front counter procedures, applications easier to fill out, criteria easier to address. People know what they need to do. And so hopefully we will have more permits that are approved because they meet the criteria and spend less time in hearings because it's pretty obvious that they do. You're going to see staff reports from us that are going to make specific findings and recommendations. That is a change. The previous planning director did not want to do that. They just kind of threw it out there and let you hash it out. Well, there's more hearings involved there, and there's more cost to the county, and there's more cost to the public in picking up the tab for those meetings rather than keeping it fairly focused on the review. So
planning director before that used to make recommendations.
Right.
They would recommend that these conditions be approval subject to or disapproval subject to.
And as I can tell you, a former consultant, that's what you look for. Is a recommendation for approval or denial? That's approval. What are the conditions? That's what you go straight.
I was rather shocked when I found out that Michael didn't do that when I first came on. I was very surprised.
Oh. And like I said, they used to do it, but he stopped it.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
But we, I think we're average cost of service.
So when
here.
We go to hearing on the 11th, it'll include the ordinance and the fees. Is that correct?
Actually, we won't.
You're right. I understand. You said we're not going to open the fee thing up.
Right.
You're just going. Okay, I got you. We're just going to assume these fees.
Hit.
Right.
Hit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's administratively how we're going to do things. I think what you're going to see after this, after home occupations, after the wireless, after all this sort of the dust has settled, after some of the LDAC recommendations go through hearings, the next thing we tackle is the procedures ordinance. The procedures ordinance is going to use type 1, 2, 3, and 4. So this is a precursor to that. It's nice to sort of fold this ordinance into what's coming, which is going to be a procedures ordinance that follows the typing outline that most jurisdictions use. And Commissioner Hogan is used to that in some jurisdictions that he's worked in. He and I have talked about it a couple of times. He's our liaison in planning, and he's in support of doing that as well. So,
sweet.
Okay, anyway. For any other business regarding the home occupations proposed ordinance article. Staff, do you feel like you have adequate guidance from those of us who are here?
Yeah, and I think we'll...
And Margaret's going to take a stab at writing a little something to add to it, maybe?
Right. And,
okay.
Take a stab at that.
And Margaret,
no pressure.
To clarify for me, what was that?
That was instead of...
We talked about a few different definitions, so what do you write?
Instead of charging the people in the exempt category, that is people who are less than Category 1, I'm going to write a proposal for
recoup it, because the only reason
for recouping the complaint
the only reason for charging for that is the cost in case someone complains. I think it makes more sense to recoup that cost when it happens.
Okay. How do you want us to bring this draft to you? Right now, 92040 says registered home occupations.
I would prefer it to say exempt.
I would prefer it to stay the same.
I prefer it to stay the same, too.
But I missed the question.
Registered
or is it exempt?
I would prefer they register.
I'd prefer exempt, but I guess it's all going to come out in the wash.
Well, they want to know.
I'm going to split the baby. We're going to
present
an ordinance that says registered slash exempt home occupation.
For exempt.
Well, we've got 3-2.
We've got a few of us who aren't even here, so we'll have.
Yeah, I'll vote for them.
That'll.
David, what would you like to say? You're the best rep.
What would I like to say?
What would you like to see?
Oh, I already said I prefer registered.
Okay.
I'll both registered.
I'm just one of them.
But we're 3-2.
Yeah.
For exempt.
Yeah. It's a democracy here. Come on.
Yeah, we're not voting though.
Yeah, this is not, I mean,
we're deriving.
You present it whichever way you like, and somebody during the discussion after the hearing will say, I recommend we do this, and it'll either go up or down.
It's right. Going to be part of a motion, yeah.
Yeah, somebody will make a motion, and if it's me, it'll be exempt.
That's the democratic process.
So someone's going to have to jump in there ahead of me if they want to get rid of it.
You're going to make an exempt motion.
Okay. We'll probably throw it at the hearing as written, and the discussion will happen, and the vote will happen, and we'll go with it. Whatever that is, we'll go from there. But I think leaving the language in there that defines what that is something I'd like to keep in there. Whether it's
right. So you do have some changes you're going to make.
Well, I think the language there actually
defines phrases, right?
Type one, yeah.
There were some changes you're going to make to the draft, though, based on tonight's conversation.
Yeah, but we didn't have any changes to that section.
Right. Okay, I just wanted to clarify.
Whether it's registered or...
You're not saying... I was afraid you were saying the whole thing.
I'm changing residents, I'm changing exterior modeling, and adding lemonade.
And I'm 100% for that.
Yeah.
But I still think, you know, and I had a home occupation, and I had nobody come in my driveway, but... I still registered.
I think we're done with the ordinance. There was an item number 2 on the agenda that I didn't know about. Maybe Stan did, but did you want to discuss Planning Commission hearings workshop protocol?
Okay.
With only 5 members present, I don't
we skipped
so.
Over that. Okay.
What we were going to talk about was things like the and some of this we dealt with the other night on the. No TV, only audio. We had at the previous meeting some off-camera discussions, off-the-microphone discussions. Stepped away from the microphone and had discussions on the maps that were there. And,
That's a little tough when you got these maps that are not right up at the on the lectern.
Yeah,
that's a tough situation.
You know, we. Today we finally got them electronically. Those maps that you saw on the federal access roads, we got them electronically. Huge file sizes. I'm not even sure that you know the laptop could handle it in 100 megabytes. And,
it would have been good if they could have been put on the overhead for traffic.
The road system information, did that come from BLM Forestry?
We have the overlay in GIS. So that was done internally.
But the base information probably came from
there. Basis was probably up.
I bet it did.
Yeah, we got their shape files here. But the only thing that we haven't covered, and we've had 2 or 3 letters from it, is the residences and commercial properties.
And those were handed out at the last workshop.
Right,
they were handed out.
And that memo that David wrote had the new language.
Right. So I'd like to get at least a quick.
Can you give me a copy of this?
And you and.
I have to right now.
We have, you know, the first workshop we had on home occupations, when that came up, it garnered quite a bit of discussion.
and then the subcommittee didn't get to that issue. Literally ran out of time.
I support that. I think that, you know, I mean, having well, somebody being able to...
Yeah, right now, it's your memo of April 3rd blend. Mm-hmm. If you've got a manufactured home, you can have it on your commercial property, but you can't have a house on your property, and you can't live in the back. And some of these, especially older ones, we have one at Kirby, one I can think of, where there's actually a residence that was built in the back. It's granted it was built without permits, but it's there. But it mimics a traditional American architecture where you've got the business in front and the residence in the back. The Kirby Market has that, and they live in it, and it predates Mr. Scheinrock's, what's it called? It's a borough, predates the code. Lives in the property, business
which
and money.
Which part predates the code? What predates the code is residential?
Yeah,
as a resident in the commercial zone.
Because he's,
I mean,
most of that building is only 10 years old or less, but maybe it's older stuff.
Yeah, the front structure for the
The thing with the funny roof line, all the red.
Yeah, all the retail site.
Yeah.
Okay. So your letter of April 30th, your memo of April 30th, discusses that.
Right, and put some language out there.
And put some language, but that's language in Article 11, not Article...
Right.
So
no, 62.
Or, okay, I'm sorry, 62 and 63.
And we not the 92 that we're 92. And we added 62 to the DLCD notice, so we covered it in the state.
62 is actually the article that pertains to commercial properties.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we've had this a couple times in the Planning Commission. The latest one was when we did the Colvin Oil stuff. They wanted a caretaker residence. Probably about a year before you got here.
Okay.
But he was doing a reconstruction, remodeling, and he wanted a caretaker on site because all the gas functions.
He's in an industrial building.
Industrial or commercial, I don't know which
he's
one.
He's in industrial. In industrial, there is a caretaker provision in the code. What we don't have is permanent residence. In the commercial zone, unless you're in a manufactured home. Manufactured home,
and it has to be removed if the business that it's in place in conjunction with, if it leaves, then the mobile home has to leave also.
That's only allowed in mini storage, last time I heard.
No, it's commercial zone.
Then they changed it.
Anyway, that was the last issue that it came up at the Planning Commission.
We just figured, you know, we're talking about the rural area. Why should you have to have a house in one place, your business in another?
Absolutely.
There's nobody living on site. You're in a rural area with not a lot of traffic. There's more, you know, possibility for vandalism and break-ins and that sort of thing.
And also, it's just easier for somebody to run a business if they can live there and they don't have to maintain, you know, separate
two properties.
Isn't the OPC and to some point the state kind of pushing back towards that? For your rural centers.
Yeah, you get your, you know, Main Streets initiatives and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense.
Yeah. That's total sense. Yeah. I'd like to see the same thing with forestry and farm, but I don't know what happened with the state.
I'd like to see allowed everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
So nobody has a concern if we add this 5 to Article 62.040.E, residential occupancy of the business providing such dwelling is on the same property and meets the residential occupancy requirements of the building code. Everybody's happy with that?
I'm fine.
Then you should bring it forward.
We'll go with that.
Yep.
Okay. Sounds good. Are we done?
Yep.
Thank you, sir.
Remember, Javel.
We're adjourned. Yeah.